Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. What's your guess? In? Out? Brexit? Remain? All right, sorry. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you along on this Wednesday, everybody. It's the 22nd of June, which makes tomorrow the 23rd, Election Day, Brexit Day, possibly over in the UK. A potentially momentous day in the history of the idea of a united Europe. But let's pause here for just a minute and ask this question. What about us? I mean, right? The U.S. financial sector is as concerned as anybody about this. In fact, a report out today shows Wall Street banks spent about $3 million lobbying against an exit. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour gets us going.
It's hard to walk down Wall Street and find a voice in support of the U.K. leaving the EU.
It can't bode well for the markets long term.
Lauren DeLuca is an investor. He puts money in early stage companies.
Certainly any type of economic instability or geographic instability, I guess, really weighs heavily on the markets.
Even Jamie Dimon, the head of JP Morgan Chase, has come out to lobby against Brexit, which he has called a terrible deal. Here's what he said on a visit to one of his UK offices.
They will change the laws and how we can service our clients around the EU.
Every major U.S. financial firm has substantial operations in London. They use London as a gateway to the European banking system.
The UK banks have an access to the Eurozone payment system.
Ilaria Maselli is in Brussels. She's a senior economist at the conference board. Cut off the UK, cut off the banks.
American firms would then lose access to the European single market.
David Hilder is senior bank analyst at Drexel Hamilton.
Financial firms in London, whether they're U.S. or based anywhere else, might have to set up duplicate operations somewhere in Europe.
Duplicate operations, duplicate regulations. He says this can cost a firm like JP Morgan dearly over time.
I mean, potentially on the order of hundreds of millions of dollars.
But there's actually a much bigger concern for U.S. financial firms and investors.
If the U.K. leaves, there's increased uncertainty that the EU will survive.
Campbell Harvey is professor of finance at Duke.
If there's increased uncertainty or increased risk, then people are going to think twice before making an investment.
An investment not just in the U.K., but in Europe generally.
That hits economic growth.
It'd be, he says, putting the brakes on growth in the European Union, the second largest economy in the world.
With that increased risk, with lower growth prospects in the EU, that bites U.S. economic growth very directly. And we all know that when there's negative implications for economic growth in the U.S., that bodes poorly for the financial sector.
This is, of course, a worst-case scenario. The reality is nobody knows exactly how this will play out. But not knowing, that's almost as bad in the world of finance. Cheerio. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
We have heard this week what the Greeks think about the looming referendum and the Spaniards. Today, Germany, arguably the biggest pillar of the European Union, definitely its biggest economy. The BBC's business correspondent Rob Young is in Berlin. Hello, Rob.
Hi.
First things first, what's the mood? What's the general chatter over there, I suppose, in Berlin?
Many Berliners I've been talking to are absolutely gripped by the referendum campaign taking place in Britain. There is wall-to-wall TV coverage of it. It is in every newspaper that I have picked up. Because remember, Germany was one of the founding nations, one of the architects originally of what has become the European Union. And many people here fear that the continent could perhaps move backwards in some way, economically or politically, if the UK, one of Europe's biggest economies, does vote to leave.
Do they fear for Germany's economy or the larger European experiment as a whole?
Both, frankly. There was a survey today, and it found that A third of manufacturers think that there will be a negative impact on their business if Britain votes to leave. And I've been talking to the head of the German Industrial Association, the BDI, and he told me that if Britain does vote to leave, and if the European Union, or what remains of the European Union, and Britain fail to do a free trade deal, he fears there would be job losses among German manufacturers. If, for example, there were export-import tariffs slapped on German or British goods. But of course, this has not happened before, so we do not know what kind of a deal Britain might get.
What do you make of some of the analysis and some of the statements from German leaders that goes like this? You know what? If the Brits leave, then what we have to do is be really strict with them and almost punish them so that nobody else gets the idea that they can leave the European Union. I mean, Schäuble, the foreign minister, said, or the finance minister said, if you're out, you're out.
Yeah, Wolfgang Schäuble has said, out is out. If you leave the European Union, you leave the European single market, a trading bloc of a potential 500 million consumers. But of course, it may well be that the German government and others are talking tough to try to persuade British voters to vote in favour of staying rather than leaving. Certainly the senior German industrialist I've been talking to says that he would be putting pressure on his government and on the EU to give Britain some kind of a free trade deal because they don't want to sell fewer German-made cars or machines to the Brits.
Is it your sense that the Germans you have spoken to would rather have Britain unenthusiastically in than unenthusiastically out, given how close the polling is over there?
There are a couple of schools of thought on this. Some people do not want to see the European Union, a club which originally was six nations more than half a century ago, now grown to 28. They don't want to see that reduce in size because they fear that might be the end of what they regard as the ideal of the European Union. But the German finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, he has said that even if a majority in Britain votes to stay, he says the European Union cannot go on as before. He said otherwise the people will say you just didn't understand anything. So it seems that whichever way this vote in Britain goes, there is perhaps a sense that it has already changed the course of this continent.
Rob Young, the BBC's business correspondent, we got him, as you can hear, on the streets of Berlin. Rob, thanks very much.
Thanks, Guy.
Polls close at 10 London time tomorrow night, 5 p.m. in the east, 2 o'clock in the afternoon out here on the West Coast. You can check marketplace.org for our timeline of what has happened so far in the Brexit debate. The effect on Wall Street today was a whole lot of market time hanging out, just waiting. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Elon Musk, the CEO of Tesla, is an interesting fellow. We've had him on the program a couple of times, and he is back in the news today. The electric car company that he runs has offered to buy the alternative energy company SolarCity. A couple of things to mention about that. First of all, Tesla has real balance sheet problems. SolarCity does too. Also, Elon's cousins run SolarCity, and he owns 22% of that company. Musk, however, says the move is a no-brainer. Marketplace's Andy Euler gets to the bottom of what's going on here.
So it's a car company buying a construction company. Kinda. But Tesla's website calls itself an energy innovation company. SolarCity's a full-service solar provider. So if this deal goes down, there's got to be some what economists call synergy here, right?
I don't see what the point is, because you don't have any of the usual rationales.
That's Robert Michaels. He's a professor of economics at Cal State Fullerton.
In fact, you've got some good rationales for not putting them under central control.
Michaels says the classic reason companies merge or vertically integrate is to cut costs. That's not what's going on here. Right now, these are two vastly different companies. A comparison would be Ford merging with ExxonMobil. But there's a lot of other stuff going on here. Don't forget, SolarCity is run by two of Elon Musk's cousins, and Musk owns about a quarter of the company's stock. He's on both company boards and, as a result, won't vote himself on the merger. Ben Kahlo is senior research analyst at Robert W. Baird. He thinks this move might make sense in the long run, but...
In the short term, this is something that Tesla shareholders, and me included, as an analyst here, you kind of scratch your head and say, you know, why now?
The proposal would be an all-stock deal, and SolarCity's price has fallen about three-quarters from its peak in early 2014.
The why now could be because Elon thinks that the shares are undervalued, so now's the right time to buy it.
Which makes it sound like a classic Elon Musk move, looking to the future and leveraging a lot of other people's money, betting that people who want electric cars and solar power are one and the same. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
There's been kind of an amazing thing going on in the House of Representatives today. Democrats are staging a sit-in trying to force Republicans to allow a vote on gun bills. Interesting, but not necessarily our story. The amazing thing for us is that because the television cameras in the chamber aren't on when the House is adjourned, lawmakers have been using social media, Periscope and Facebook Live, private sector companies, to broadcast the thing. The sound is lousy, but here's a sample.
My brothers and sisters,
Hank Johnson, Georgia.
How happy I am to be a member of Congress today.
I don't know if you could hear it, but that was Representative Scott Peters, Democrat of California, doing the play-by-play, the back announce, as we say in the radio business, IDing the speaker, Congressman Hank Johnson, out of Georgia. All right, moving on. Since he took over the Late Late Show on CBS last year, James Corden has endeared himself to his fans. And one big reason that that has happened is something called carpool karaoke. He hops in a car, Corden does, picks up his favorite musical celeb, and the two go for a drive. They chat, they laugh, and then they sing along to that artist's greatest hits. Tens of millions of views on YouTube later. Of course, sponsors have decided to come along for the ride. This week, McDonald's and Coke jumped in. Ashley Miltide has more on that.
In the latest carpool karaoke, James Corden hits the road with singer Selena Gomez. Partway through their ride, they pull up to a McDonald's drive-thru.
What you want?
Number seven.
A number seven, with a medium fries and a medium Coke.
McDonald's features for about 4 minutes. The video has had 10 million views in less than 2 days. Dade Hayes is editor of Broadcasting and Cable magazine.
In a way, sort of back to the future.
He says if you think of late night's roots.
You had the early hosts. Jack Parr, I mean, certainly in the early days of television, they would do long segments extolling the virtues of a sponsor.
Today, it's all much more subtle. Rebecca Poehler of the Paley Center for Media says that McDonald's stop in the video seems natural.
Which is what James Corden is all about. I don't think of him as this big huckster pushing things. You know, I think of him as this likable guy.
Which is exactly what advertisers are banking on. Shama Haider runs the marketing Zen Group.
It's just the tip of the iceberg. I think we'll see this happening a lot more because brands are realizing that this is new advertising and it's taking advantage of influencers and going to meet the people where they are.
And where younger viewers are is on YouTube. She says it's just a question of companies finding the right person or celebrity their audience can relate to. I'm Ashley Miltite for Marketplace.
Coming up,
more skyscrapers have been built since 2001 than in the entire century preceding it.
And rebuilt, too. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 49 points today, about a quarter percent, 17,780 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ gave up 10 points, about 0.2%, 48.33. The S&P 500 dipped 3 points, a tenth percent, 2,085. Universal Electronics in the remote control business is on a roll, trading near its all-time high. Shares up 3.2% today. Universal Display Corporation, it makes flat panel displays for tablets, phones, and gadgets. Universal Display off a half percent. Universal Forest Products, also trading near its all-time high. It makes wood and wood alternative products for builders. Universal Forest Products down 1.4% today. I love my job, man. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.68%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Treasury Department gave its annual report on the economic health of Medicare and Social Security today. Medicare's fund that pays for seniors' hospital costs can cover its obligations until 2028. One way to stretch that time out would be to reduce Medicare fraud. And it so happens that today the Department of Justice announced the biggest crackdown on Medicare fraud in that program's history. In a 3-day sweep, more than 300 people have been charged with defrauding Medicare and Medicaid in schemes totaling more than $900 million. Official estimates are that scams and other improper payments cost this country's two biggest healthcare programs tens of billions of dollars every year.
Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein was with federal agents on a fraud raid earlier this week.
The sun has just come up here in Brooklyn. We're standing in a big parking lot of empty big box stores. Seagulls overhead and several dozen agents have gathered together.
Good morning. Thanks, everybody, for being on time.
Scott Lampert is the lead agent here in New York with the Office of the Inspector General, part of Health and Human Services.
This investigation is what we call the Pikus investigation. It's been going on about 8 years. So in about 5 minutes, we're going to head out to various parts of Brooklyn. Okay, good luck. See you soon.
As innocuous-looking sedans and dark SUVs get rolling, the plan is to arrest five subjects, all tied to one guy, Alexander Pikus, OIG's Tom O'Donnell.
And he's been somebody that we've heard about for a long time, sort of a mastermind.
Pikus was arrested and arraigned Monday, charged with money laundering, tied to more than $80 million in false billing. O'Donnell says, on paper, Pikus was the guy who billed Medicare and Medicaid for clinics running schemes.
But Alexander Pikus took it to another level, where he was a consultant for some of these clinics and could teach them how to defraud Medicare and Medicaid.
In court, Pikus pleaded not guilty. Here's Pikus's court-appointed attorney, Joel Cohen.
We have yet to sit down and have a full-blown discussion about everything alleged in the indictment, but by entering a not guilty plea, essentially denied his guilt of the charges contained in the indictment.
Pikus, of course, is just one of several hundred people targeted in this week's sweep, but OIG says the fact that officers finally had enough to charge him after chasing him for nearly a decade means the office is getting better at going after the bad guys.
I think the thing that really is different is the speed with which we are able to do our jobs.
Anne Maxwell is an assistant inspector general. In the last 5 years, Maxwell says the team has gained access to real-time data for Medicare and Medicaid. They've hired a chief data officer and expect to add 10 staff to that office this year.
In the past, when we didn't have the kind of computing capability that we do have in the modern age, trying to determine a national scope could take weeks, months, sometimes even years. Now we're talking about a couple hours.
The federal government estimates it loses 12% of Medicare spending and 10% of Medicaid to fraud and other improper payments. Last year, that totaled more than $70 billion. Those familiar with the program acknowledge that could be much, much higher.
I believe fraud does continue to run rampant and remains largely unchecked.
That's Harvard's Malcolm Sparrow. Sparrow doubts much will change until controls are put in place that make it harder to exploit the current automated billing system, which processes claims in most cases by computer with no human involvement.
These are beautiful targets from a criminal's perspective. So you can test the system and then you can just submit tens of thousands of claims. I'm absolutely sure, because it's automated, that they're all going to be paid.
This is what the feds allege Alexander Pikus did: learned to play the system and got $80 million for the effort. More sophisticated data helped OIG finally shut down a scheme that's been bleeding taxpayers for at least 8 years. But that more sophisticated data also makes it perfectly clear there are tons of fish in this sea, and OIG only has so many nets. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
I was in the most amazing elevator the other day, headed up to the top of the tallest building in the Western Hemisphere.
And then here we go into a section that imitates the bedrock on which this tower is founded.
You've seen it, I'm sure, the latest addition to the New York City skyline.
That's the wall you want to look at.
Author and architectural writer Judith Dupre was my guide.
The Lenape.
Her latest book is the authorized history of the 12 years that it took to design, agree on, and then build this tower.
And then the skyscraper
started. Lower Manhattan, there's Trinity Church.
In 1920. Oh, the years ticking by.
Yep, we're at 500 feet. The years are ticking by. You see the Brooklyn Bridge, Empire State Building.
Wow.
And now look, the only time you see a reference to the Twin Towers, just for a moment.
Oh, my God. And then they go away.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. All right, you know what? It'd be cool to do that again, because that was awesome.
Welcome to One World Observatory.
Wow. That was cool.
The 102nd floor of One World Trade Center is the highest public vantage point in New York City.
Okay, so now we're looking north, and this is absolutely the money shot.
Yeah.
Right ahead of you, Empire State Building. And if you look east, you'll see some of New York's great bridges.
Yeah.
You'll see the United Nations building, the only building by Le Corbusier in this country.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
And looking way uptown, the very at the top, you can see George Washington, Bridge, very first Hudson Crossing that was built for cars.
Yeah.
You know, people think of New York City as a very exciting metropolis, but the fact is we have extraordinary geology here. And one of the greatest things you're going to see from this window is this rippling pattern of short buildings, and then we go up in Midtown to skyscrapers. And that indicates where the bedrock is, where the Manhattan
is
schist
that what
is.
It is. Seriously?
Yes.
Oh, that's
that allows
so
these very tall towers, which need deep foundations to be built.
You can see everything from here, right?
You can see
God,
forever.
The river's busy today. Look at that. Talk to me for a minute about the Port Authority, because its role in the reconstruction of this site, as you talk about in the book, was not an easy one, because it was not built as a redevelopment agency, right? I mean, that's
exactly
not what it's for.
So the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey is a bi-state agency. Its expertise, its extraordinary expertise, is in large-scale transportation projects.
Right.
But they owned the World Trade Center land. And so when the Twin Towers went down, they had the right to rebuild it. I don't think they wanted to rebuild it, but
they couldn't not. I mean, it was pretty clear right at the beginning.
They absolutely felt a moral obligation to rebuild it, and Governor George Pataki, governor of New York,
said in September 2001, we're going to do it. Yeah.
You have to do it. And the thing is, it would make sense for the city, for instance, to have rebuilt this. They simply did not have the financial resources that this project needed.
I need a word here about Larry Silverstein, the guy who owned the lease on this land,
yes,
who I spoke to in 2005 in number 7 World Trade Center as it was being finished out. He was the guy in the news because he owned the 99-year lease on the land.
Exactly.
When the towers went down.
Exactly.
Tell me
so
about
6
him.
Weeks before September 11th, Larry Silverstein purchased the lease to the Trade Center. And that gave him the right to redevelop these towers. 6 weeks later, the Twin Towers go down. And to his credit, he was determined to rebuild. And he was relentless in his efforts.
He was the businessman in this enterprise, right?
He
you had government agencies,
was.
You had bureaucrats, and then you had Larry Silverstein who said, I'm out billions of dollars. Help me out here.
Yes, exactly. Larry Silverstein had the legal right to rebuild, but to get his insurance proceeds, he had to rebuild in kind, meaning he had to replace what was lost here. And what was lost here was almost 11 million square feet of commercial real estate. That's why there are no residential towers on this site.
There's a cool elevator ride on the way down, too. I'm not going to spoil that one for you. Judith Dupre and I continued our conversation down on the plaza, just next to the footprints of the Twin Towers and those reflecting pools. There was a time not long after September 11th when people were saying the skyscraper is dead, that, I mean, we're never going up in a skyscraper again.
Yeah.
And this site had to overcome that.
Yes. And it's still overcoming it. There's a lot of people here, most visited place in the country, but it's also a place where many people are not quite ready to return. But as far as skyscraper construction goes, more skyscrapers have been built since 2001 than in the entire century preceding it.
Hmm.
So we are absolutely in the midst of a skyscraper boom.
Yeah. You use the word morass more than a couple of times in this book to talk about the project, to talk about the bureaucracy, to talk about the construction.
Right.
I mean, honestly, it's amazing anything got done.
Exactly. I think that what's important to remember is that my book is the very first history of this new project. There'll be other histories that come. Something like 85 agencies, organizations, had a legitimate claim to make to this site. Many, many, many people had to be accommodated. There were tremendous disagreements. There were negotiations. Everyone had a right to speak, and that includes a fair swath of the 8 million people who call New York home. And they did. Many did. And everything was considered. This is a place of democracy. And I see it, and I see people visiting and working and sitting in the sun. And I saw a lady changing her baby's diaper on one of the granite benches the other day. And I thought, you know what? Yeah, this is what exactly was hoped for.
You make the point in the book that cities need buildings like this.
Yes, yes. Everything cannot be utilitarian. Much has been made of the delays and the cost down here. There were lots of practical reasons for that, but these designs gave a little bit more. We don't want to have cities that are totally utilitarian. This tower stands as proof, despite all the troubles and the evil in the world. It is proof of what human beings are capable of. And when you see this building coming down the west side, coming down the east side, you know, from Brooklyn, from Queens, from Staten Island, you think, wow, this is what human beings are capable of. And it ennobles all of us.
I would drop the mic right there and walk away. Boom. What? Yeah. Author Judith Dupre at One World Trade Center not too long ago. Her new book is called One World Trade Center, Biography of the Building. We took some pictures while we were walking and talking. You can see them at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, either this week's sign of the apocalypse is upon us or conceivably tasty, tasty goodness. Burger King's got a new snack it's working on. Deep fried sticks of macaroni and cheese coated in Cheetos flavored breading. Mac and Cheetos, they will be called. Come on, how good is that going to be, huh? All right, got to go. The Dow off 49 points today, about a quarter percent. The NASDAQ gave up 10 points, about 0.2%. The S&P 500 down 0.3%. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. How about Flamin' Hot Mac and Cheetos?
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.